we'll jump right
where,
in.
Where am I?
yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
Many people, I would say, would imagine a world of difference between the jazz clubs of Philadelphia, which is where we left
right.
off, and the Monkees of John Mason. But
right.
you saw connections. And so let's go to that sort of moment
right.
and consider the question of how important it was that you drew that connection. How did personal connections with people who have dealt or used drugs shaped your commitments?
Well, I think, first of all, that I have always felt a great deal of compassion for individuals who have become addicted to drugs, because I witnessed the transformation from people, you know, who just were playing around with drugs to becoming truly addicted and unable to stop, despite the fact that they were quite aware of the fact that there were huge deleterious consequences to their continued use. Secondly, I guess I also came out of it with a feeling that that to deal with it as a problem of morality didn't make any sense to me either. I didn't think of these people as being immoral, perhaps because I knew them prior to the time that they became involved with drugs, and by and large they were, you know, most of them were pretty decent individuals, and for a variety of reasons got involved with drugs and became addicted to them. So it just made sense to me to think of it as a behavioral disorder that they needed treatment, and that's anything we could do to learn more about the whole phenomena might contribute to that. And so I was really excited about the notion of studying drugs as reinforcers. And as I said before, I thought at first that I was going to have to do something very complicated. Little did I know that I didn't have to trick the animals into taking drugs. I didn't have to make them physically dependent on an opiate in order for the opiate to serve as a positive reinforcer. All I had to do was make them available. And I found very, very few animals who would not learn to emit some type of operant response in order to, when you use drugs as a consequence for that. And, you know, we were able to do studies of many different things. First of all, back when I was a jazz musician, I had seen people who, when they didn't have drugs, would sit around and play with needles, even injecting themselves. They were so-called needle freaks. In a sense, you could make a monkey a needle freak too, and that is by associating stimuli with the drug. After a while, those stimuli became conditioned reinforcers, and so I looked at needle freaks as an instance of individuals who were engaging in a behavior that was frequently associated with drug use, and therefore the whole act of taking the drug, cooking it up, etc., had some conditioned reinforcing properties. So we were able to study that in animals. I was able to study the fact that when they went into withdrawal, they would work to a much greater extent for drugs, opiates specifically. I was surprised at the fact that the drugs that animals would take were, by and large, the same drugs that some humans got into trouble with. And so it just was amazing. I mean, you know, the concordance. We marched through the pharmacopoeia, you know, testing this drug, that drug. And drugs that are aversive in humans, such as the phenothiazines, the antipsychotic drugs, which nobody likes, animals would actually learn to perform a response to avoid injections of them. So they served as negative reinforcers. So, the concordance was just striking, absolutely striking. I don't know of any animal model in any area of psychiatry that has both face validity and construct validity the way the drug self-administration procedures do. Now, although I was involved with some of the earliest studies, The fact is that it was sort of a zeitgeist phenomenon. Jim Weeks at the University of Michigan was doing similar things in rats, and then Jerry Deneau and Mo Sievers and Tomoji Yanagita later Tomoji was there, I'm sorry, began to do this in rhesus monkeys. And I just was, I was around at the right time and saw the connection, as did they. We were interested in learning more about, the field of addiction. And so Travis Thompson and I, and Travis was the a postdoc in the lab that when I was in getting my degree at the University of Maryland. And we worked together on these projects. We went to see Nathan Bieti, who was, of course, the founder of the Committee on Problems of Drug Dependence. And he was at NIH, and he was in this funny building off campus that had to have structural supports for his office because he had so many books in there that the floors were collapsing. And he was virtually blind, but he read vociferously with a magnifying glass. I mean, just read everything, and he was a real scholar. So we went to see him, and he said, "Well, why don't you come out to this meeting that's going to take place in Ann Arbor and give a report on that?" And it was a meeting of the Committee on Problems of Drug Dependence. And we came out to Ann Arbor and gave the report, and afterwards, Jerry Deneau came to me and said, "Mo Sievers wants to hire you for the Department of Pharmacology." I had just gotten my degree from Maryland, and I said, "Oh, well, I had a grant from NIH, and it was for $28,000 a year, which was a huge amount of money at that time, and they offered me a salary of $12,500. And I said, "Wow, that's great." So I moved to Ann Arbor.
So now, did you see your work, did you differentiate your work on self-administration from their work on physical dependence
at
the time?
Well, yes. First of all, even when they had animals who were self-injecting drugs, their interest was in really sort of the toxic consequences of these drugs at doses that the animals would voluntarily take. Mm-hmm. I was interested in the behavioral aspects of drug self-administration, and they were very much interested in the consequences of it. And so I've spoken to Tomoji Yanagita about this, and he says, "No, I wasn't really interested in the behavior. I was interested in what happens to the animals when they did this." And he has these films where he would let monkeys self-inject drugs to the point that they were collapsing, and he would, he was very interested in describing what happened to them when they were allowed free access to drugs.
He still has these films?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes, he's at this meeting. Unfortunately, he collapsed last night at the dinner that we were holding, and I don't know what's happened. They took him to the hospital, but his autobiography is coming out in July in the British Journal of the Addictions.
Oh, okay.
I interviewed him in
Japan.
Oh,
you did?
Yes.
It's so funny. You guys are interviewing each other just as those of us external are getting interested
well,
in interviewing.
You're right. Well, I have to tell you, though, it was pretty humorous when my secretary tried to type up what Tomoji was saying with his Japanese accent.
Yeah.
She typed some pretty funny things, but we managed to get it together.
Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's how I would differentiate it. Okay. I was interested in the behavior.
Okay, and what about the Lexington folks?
Well, they were... Abe Wickler was really excited about the research that we were doing, mm-hmm. One of the Committee on Problems of Drug Dependence meetings was actually held in Lexington, and Jim Woods and I went down there. we missed our plane. Jim is always late. And
well, that's good to know. I have an interview scheduled
right,
with him tomorrow.
Right, and we got into this car, into this taxi, going from Ann Arbor to the airport. And the woman who was driving it, well, the steering wheel disappeared into her stomach, let me put it that way. And she was the owner of the taxi cab company. Her husband had started, and he had died. And during the afternoons, just for boredom reasons, she'd drive. She hated to go to the airport. We got out on the highway, and she was going 35 miles an hour. And we said, you know, we're going to miss our plane. And she would say to us, got her to the floor, fellows, got her to the floor. So if, for the past 40 years, Jim and I repeat that, got her to the floor, fellas. We missed the plane. We caught a later plane, but we couldn't make the connecting plane to get to Lexington. We hired an airplane and to fly us over from, I forget, another, big city in Kentucky to Lexington to
well,
make the meeting.
I was going to ask you about the isolation of Lexington, so that's a great story.
Yeah, we got there, but, and, you know, it always cracked me up that they called these places the narcotics farm. It sounded to me like that's a place you grow narcotics.
Yeah, right.
And then, to make matters worse, they had a factory inside there where they made clothing mm-hmm. for the other prisons.
Yes.
It was called the Needleworks.
I have to tell you, in I looked at the early papers at the National Archives, and there's this wonderful letter in there from, I think it was Sears Kenmore, sales rep, writing about Lawrence Cobb and saying, the man knows nothing about running a sewing facility.
That's probably
so the Needleworks.
Yes, the Needleworks. I looked at that and I said, are you guys kidding? And they looked at me as if they didn't get it. I mean, they hadn't made the connection. I mean, I can't believe they hadn't, but it was called the Needleworks. Lexington was a fascinating place. Gene Krupa was busted on a marijuana charge and sent there. And he contended he could play better under marijuana than not. And they did a study where they got him to play under the influence of marijuana and not under the influence of marijuana. And then they had a lot of other jazz musicians were always there. They always had great jazz concerts at the place. And they got them to judge the two recordings to see if there was a difference. They couldn't tell any difference. but he thought he was better. So that's one of the... I've been told that. I don't know whether that was ever written up officially.
Well, that's a question. The loss of Lexington, of course, meant that researchers had less social contact
correct.
With their subjects.
That's correct. I think that's absolutely true. I think I understand the ethical concerns about informed consent in prisoners. And I'm not going to get into that debate, but I do really believe that the research that came out of Lexington was some of the most important research that has ever been done in the addictions, and it could not have taken place really at anywhere else. Now, it's interesting that after Isbell and Cole, Bill Martin became the chief there, and Bill Martin was a phenomenally good pharmacologist and a really, really superb researcher. However, he had an opinion about cocaine that I did not share. I had done extensive animal research with cocaine, and when the cocaine epidemic started, I decided that I wanted to do human cocaine research, and he was convinced that I was running the risk of what in the trade is called icing people, of killing them by virtue of a cardiac conduction block because of the local anesthetic properties of cocaine. And I said, Bill, I'm not a physician, but I have given cocaine to hundreds of rhesus monkeys, and I have never seen an idiosyncratic death. yes, I have killed monkeys with cocaine, but only at very, very high dosages. I've never seen, you know, a low dose cause a cardiovascular event. And so Dr. Marion Fishman and I, at the request of Norm Krasnegor, who was at Knight at that time, decided we would begin to do human research. I know I'm skipping ahead. This is at the University of Chicago, and would have been in the 70s, early 70s.
Or, I was going to ask you when you thought that that cocaine epidemic started.
Well, it you know, the Woody Allen movies, you know, like, I forget the exact date of that, but, you know, and everybody cracking up when he would sneeze and blow the line away. Do you realize the cocaine at that time was more expensive than gold? Mm-hmm. It was over $400 an ounce. And so the issue of, you know, rampant dependence and so forth, I mean, it was for the jet set. Well, interestingly enough, when we applied for, we had to apply for an IND from the Food and Drug Administration in order to be able to do a cocaine study. And so we got the cardiologists in, at the University of Chicago involved with us because we obviously wanted them on board and to be there when we gave cocaine. The first thing the FDA did was that they went out and they got a consultant to review this, and they came back to us and said we could only use people who used cocaine 3 times a day, every day, for the last 3 months. And we said, that's not the way people use cocaine. They were, they said, well, that's what our consultant said. So we had, knew a person who graduated from the law school at the University of Chicago who never became a lawyer. I mean, never got his license because of his drug use, but he knew all the jet set people, had an apartment uptown. So we, for about a month, went every evening and sat there, and when friends would drop in, we would interview them about the pattern of their cocaine use. And we collected enough data to convince FDA that that's not how, that people didn't take cocaine every day, 3 times a day, like they do heroin.
Yes.
You know, it's a binge and, you know, binge phenomena. And so we went back and they allowed us to do it. Well, the vice president for research at the University of Chicago got wind of the fact that we were going to give cocaine to people, and he had to sign off on this because we got a grant to do it. He said, by God, Schuster, if you kill somebody, I'm going to run you out of town. And everybody was petrified. And so we began with, you know, homeopathic doses and went up very, very carefully in terms of doses intravenously and established the fact that obviously we used people who had who were using cocaine and had no interest in treatment or quitting. And we did a number of studies to characterize the cardiovascular and subjective effects of cocaine, its similarity to amphetamines, and so forth, and established this, a dosage range for intranasal and IV cocaine, which could be safely given, and we could study other things about it. We studied its effect on performance, and like amphetamines, performance that has been deteriorated because of sleep deprivation is enhanced with cocaine. We, Marion and I had to keep people up overnight in order to do this study, and we were all we would all fall asleep. So unbeknownst to the rest of the world, the way we kept them awake was at around 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd say, okay, guys, we'd all get in my car, we'd drive downtown, and we would take a walking architectural tour of downtown Chicago till the sun came up. And once the sun came up, we would be able to stay awake. I couldn't tell the university because, of course, liability issues. I mean, if, you know, if I had an accident or, you know, something, driving these people around town, sleep deprived. And that's not in the methods section of the paper either. But, I mean, you know, we just, we say we kept them awake, and that's how we did it.
So that's your interest in performance enhancing.
Yes,
drugs.
correct, yes.
An offside question, did you know Howard Becker? Was he there at that point?
Well, Howard Becker was at Northwestern University, and Howard was a great piano player and a great jazz musician. He was rather a private person, as I would describe him, and I've been at meetings with him, I've talked to him, but I never socialized with him. If I remember properly, he hated nightclubs because he hated cigarette smoke. Huh. And so he didn't...
It's not my image of him.
I understand. Well, maybe this was subsequent or something, but there were great jazz nightclubs in Chicago that I frequented all the time.
So you didn't, though, you didn't go the sociological sort of route at all.
You mean in terms of research?
Yeah. I mean, well, you described doing these qualitative interviews about patterns of use.
Right. Well, yes and no. I mean, when I first came to Chicago, I mean, here I was doing monkey research at the University of Michigan, and I was there for 6 years, and I learned a lot of pharmacology because we had to run pharmacology labs for the medical students, and I had to do all kinds of things that psychologists shouldn't know about, but I learned them. And so it was really like an extended postdoc for me, and it was marvelous. Worked with great people there. And Jim Woods, who you'll be interviewing tomorrow, came there as my research assistant. And when I went, then I was asked to come to Chicago and give a lecture, and I did. And Jerry Jaffe had just been named the director of IDAP.
Yes, IDAP.
The Illinois Drug Abuse Treatment Program.
Yes.
IDAP was probably the first statewide publicly funded treatment program in the United States. And it was actually facilitated by a Judge Kenny Wendt, who was a marvelous guy who ran the equivalent of a drug court. All the drug cases got sent to him. And he went to the state legislature and said, we got to do something about this problem. And so he was instrumental in getting the state and the feds to set up IDAP. Well, Jerry was just absolutely a dynamite person for that. High energy, highly imaginative, etc. So here I was, a monkey researcher, but I had done a human project at the University of Michigan looking at the effects of intravenous nicotine on cigarette smoking in a blind procedure. That is, people were not told that we were studying nicotine on cigarette smoking. They were in a confined environment, and we had performance tasks, and we told them we were studying the effects of an IV drug on performance, but they were free to smoke, and we only selected smokers. And
could you do that today?
Yeah, if after the fact we were to inform them what the purpose of the study was. It was essential that they not know,
yes.
And under those circumstances, one can get IRB approval. But what we showed was two things: that there was a slight decrease in the number of cigarettes they smoked when we infused them with nicotine, and they smoked less of each cigarette because we had them put the butts in a special place and we would weigh them afterwards. And so, unfortunately, I didn't try to patent the idea of nicotine replacement therapy, or else I might be retired today, or a long time ago. No, I wouldn't have. But anyway, Jerry was very interested in my tobacco research, and recruited me to come to Chicago to be the associate administrator of the IDAP.
What caught his eye?
He thought that, well, he wanted me to come over and do more human nicotine research with him, because that was a major interest of his. Well, it's a small world. My wife had been on sabbatical at NIDA, and she helped set up their tobacco research while she was there that year. And Jerry was one of her first grantees. I, meantime, was sitting at home working on a book and on sabbatical, and she was on
a book on
behavioral pharmacology. And anyway, what we did was to she worked at night, and so Jerry was interested in nicotine and so forth. So got over there, and nicotine faded because heroin was the problem. And few people, very few, but a few used a little cocaine, but it was not at all, I mean, it was just not an issue at that point in the publicly funded treatment programs. I stayed in that position for only a few years because we had expectations about being able to do more research in that setting than, in fact, we were able to do because of state constraints. And but we did do things like LAMB. Jerry got a hold of that, and I set up this facilities for testing it, and we published that within a few months after we got the bottle of LAMB. That's in my interview, I think.
Yes.
And I did other studies, but what happened was that in the meantime, I also moved my animal lab over to the University of Chicago, and I brought one of my former graduate students came over and set it up while I was working at IDAP. When I left IDAP, I decided that I would continue to do human research, but also do monkey research. And it was really neat because we set up the Drug Abuse Research Center in Chicago, and we had beautiful facilities, but we could go from monkeys to humans and from humans to monkeys. We could go back and forth. And all of my students were trained in animal research before they ever did human research. And although that's, you know, obviously not necessary, but I think that they developed a greater rigorousness in the animal laboratory, and that carried over into the human research. Human research in two areas, benzodiazepines and amphetamines, and Griselin Johansson was the person who did that, and Marion Fishman and I did work on cocaine. And it was a very, very exciting period of time. How can I describe? I mean, work has always been important, but it was just a period where everything revolved around our research labs and the people that we worked with. I mean, Dr. Fishman built a house on the other side of the lake, right next to ours. I mean, we bought the same piece of property and divided it. I mean, so we were, you know, we were very close, very close. And it was great. We had one person in the laboratory who has shaped a lot of my feelings, and his name was Gary Reynolds. He was a African-American, grew up in the south side of Chicago. His mother was a madame for a house of prostitution. He was a pampered son by all of the women of the house. He was, by age 14 or 15, he started to dabble with drugs, and he was in the army. After he got out, he got addicted to heroin and ended up in the methadone maintenance treatment programs that I ran. And this was early on when I was just getting my animal lab started, and I hired him as a research assistant, and he was with me for many years, and he ran the place. I mean, he taught the graduate students how to do surgery. I mean, he was just fabulous. Also played drums, jazz drummer. And he married a woman with a master's degree in social work, and she started hounding him about the fact that he was still really addicted as long as he took methadone. And he stopped. And shortly after that, I was out of town. Chrisolin and I were out of town, and he became very depressed and had the foolhardy notion that cocaine would be good for his depression, and stole a bottle of cocaine from our lab, a big, big bottle, and shot it all up. And I came back and got him into the hospital, and he left there AMA, and went back into my lab and stole the rest of the cocaine. Even though I changed the lock, he was very skilled as a thief. I mean, very skilled. And, you know, he just said, you know, like, Bob, I mean, I would meet with him in places and say, you know, like, come back into treatment. And he just went off, and he's dead. And I guess the moral of the story for me was that, I mean, here was a highly productive, highly successful individual who was on a medication called methadone. And because of his stigma associated with it, unfortunately, he was encouraged to go off of it, and I think he would have continued to be successful if he had stayed on it. But he didn't. So I'm very supportive of people who find it necessary to be on methadone lifelong. Not everyone does, but for those who do, you know, they get up in the morning, they put on the shoes, and they go to work just like everybody else. And if they have to drink a little orange juice that has methadone in it, you know, my family has a history of diabetes, and, you know, they were insulin dependent, you know. So,
are you the source of the analogy that gets made today?
I think Vince Dole is responsible for that, and the group at Rockefeller, because he was interested in carbohydrate metabolism, he actually was the first person to say to Marie that, well, maybe people, you know, who are addicted to heroin, and maybe after a while their brain chemistry changes, and, you know, they, like a diabetic, they need exogenous stuff.
Oh, well, that's nice to have a source of that.
Yeah, Vince. I'm sure it was Vince, because he was a carbohydrate metabolism expert. I'm going to tell you it's 5 after, so in 5 minutes we have to leave. But I don't know how long you will be here. I know you're here today and tomorrow.
I'm here until Saturday.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, if you wish, I can arrange another time to come back for a couple of minutes, or you may be done. You've heard too much from me.
No, this is great. If you want to come back, I'm more than happy.
Well, you know, I really support this project, and I think it's important, and sure.
Yeah, I'd love to. Maybe given the kind of things that you just said, I was going to. We haven't got you tonight yet, and so it'd be great if you could come back.
Sure. I was always very active at NIDA. As a matter of fact, at one of the first jobs I ever applied for was back when NIDA was a center in National Institute of Mental Health. Roger Meyer was, I think he was in the public's, public health officer, and he was the director of it, and he was leaving, and I applied for the job, which I didn't get, and I'm very glad I didn't now. But it was 1986. Bill Pollan had left the job of being director of NIDA. And I got a call. And I said, me? No, I mean, you know, but I went down there, and it was a individual who was on the selection committee or advisory committee, whatever they call them, and I talked about my interest in research, and then I also talked about my son, who had been arrested in Florida on a marijuana charge, and his obsession with marijuana. And after I left the room, Shirley Colletti said, that's the person that we want for the director of NIDA. And I think it was in some measure because of my willingness to talk about my family experiences with drugs, my willingness to talk about my past history in terms of knowing individuals who are addicted. And she was the founder and director of an incredible program in Florida called Operation PAR, which is multimodality treatment system that she set up, and a fabulous woman. So I was shocked when I was offered the job because I was known to be very liberal in my political beliefs, and this was under President Reagan. And I was there for a few weeks, and I got to go around the world on Air Force One with Attorney General Meese, with Frank Long, the director of DEA, I think it's Arthur Keating, who became the governor of Oklahoma and was in charge of the recent, for a while he was in charge of the investigation of sexual misconduct in priests. All very interesting men, all very bright men, all very, very viciously dedicated to getting rid of drug abuse, primarily by getting rid of drug abusers. And it was a very uncomfortable situation for me because they referred to all the time as dirt bags. And AIDS was God's punishment for faggots and dirt bags. And it was a painful 2 weeks on Air Force One. Absolute denial of any ability for HIV to be transmitted heterosexually. And I tried to talk about hemophiliacs and their marital partners, but it was just, it's not a, if you regard this as a problem of unfettered hedonism and a problem of morality, then, you know, their attitude was not inappropriate. But I just don't think that it's either productive or humane to do that. Particularly, it's not productive. Don't work. It doesn't help the problem. As Peter Reuter said yesterday in his acceptance speech of the media award, you know, every bit of data that every study has ever shown has shown that treatment and prevention are far more cost-effective than supply-side reduction activities, yet the bulk of the money still goes there.
Yeah.
Well,
that's excellent. We'll end there. When should we
Well, what I'm going to do is this.